So it's June 2nd, 2006, and I'm David Brooks, the interviewer for the University of Montana's Oral History Project. And this morning I'm talking with Hank Goetz, who has been a longtime director of the field stations at the College of Forestry and
Conservation
out at the Lubrecht Experimental Forest. And I guess what I'd like you to start by talking about is just a little of your personal and educational background and what brought you to the area and to the college in the first place.
Okay, you bet. I'd be glad to. Well, I think I grew up in Wisconsin, central Wisconsin, and when I was 8-10 years old, my folks brought us out, my brother and real little sister at that time, and I out on camping trips. And when I saw these mountains, I said, "Oh man, you know, these things are okay. I'd sure like to do these." And then as I got out of high school and my interests focused more in forestry, my granddad was a farmer, I guess, and my dad's a preacher, a Lutheran minister, and my interests, I guess, ran more to the outdoors and more to the farming and the growing of things than it did the ministry. Wisconsin didn't have a forestry school. They had a little, they had graduate work at the University of Wisconsin, and they had a little podunk two-year conservation officer thing. But so I said, well, I wanted to work out west anyway. So I came out to Montana. I took a year or 2 years in Wisconsin doing preliminary stuff so I didn't have to pay the out-of-state tuition. And then came out here in 1960. And spent 3 years here and went then to the, in 63 graduated. And in those years, the draft was still in effect, and Wisconsin was really good about letting you go to school. But boy, the minute you got out of school, you went right up to the top of the list. So when I got out in the fall of, or spring of 63, I thought, boy, I know where I was going to go. So I started looking at options a little bit. I went over and talked to the recruiter, and he said, well, have you ever considered officers, candidate school? I said, I didn't really know what you're talking about, but tell me. He told me. And he said, why don't you just go on over to Butte and take the test, you know, and no obligations, whatever, and then, you know, you'll have that behind you, so if you get your draft notice, you may have an option. So I went over and did it, and this was for infantry, and of course, that was fine with me because the forestry was a good, kind of a good background, and, you know, as much as you could. And I was interested in the Army because I figured I could walk a lot further than I could swim in the Navy or fly in the Air Force, right? So I didn't want to, I said, okay, I can hack that ground pounding thing. And I was working for the Forest Service at that time up in the Blackfoot Valley. And we were on 10 days in, 4 days off, because we were back in 8 or 9 miles off the end of the road. So we had a pack string and take us in, we'd work 10 days and come out. And I came out in September, I think, one time, and there was the greetings notice, the infamous greeting notice from the draft board. Mm-hmm. And I thought, okay. So I took it down to the recruiter here, and he said, you sign here if you want to do the OCS thing, right? And I'll go ahead and take care of whatever. So I don't know what he did with the draft board. You know, predated my enlistment. I have no fucking thoughts. Mm-hmm. So anyway, then I went in the Army, did all that kind of stuff, and was an infantry officer. And I hated the garrison duty, so I volunteered for whatever came up because I just couldn't stand the garrison duty. So I was up in Alaska, was down in Dominican Republic when Johnson sent some folks down there for a little bit. And then it was over to Vietnam for a year from 65 to 66. And when I got back, my obligation was 2 years upon completion of OCS or washout, whichever. And so I came back, and I was 1 month shy of my commitment, and they said, yeah, we'll just discharge you, right? So I went back to Wisconsin to help my folks move, and then wanted to get back out in this country. So came back out, went up Sealy Lake, And I didn't want to work for, I had my fill of the government for a while after Vietnam. I didn't want to go, I didn't particularly want to work with those guys again for a while. So the Northern Pacific Railway company up there, who is a predecessor of the Plum Creek Timber, had an opening there for a forestman in Cedar Lake. So I started to work for them in 66, fall of 66, and spent then through 69, got married, met my wife there at Sealy. We got married in 68. And they wanted, the company wanted to promote me to a position in Seattle, which was kind of a stepping stone kind of position. And I said, sure, I'll go out there, but you know, I'd sure like a little bit of, you know, assurance, or say, well, you know, if that works out there, I'd like to come back to either Montana or Northern Idaho, where they had land. Also, I said I have real no desire to work out on the West Coast. Mm-hmm. And they said, well, you know, if the company, if we feel a company, you know, needs you out there, then that's where we feel we'd have to sit. So, and I made up my mind that I was going to sell my soul to that outfit. And so I turned down the job, and they had the reputation, and maybe still do for that matter. You could turn down a job, they wouldn't fire you or anything, but you'd stay where you were, you know, the rest of your natural life. And as luck would have it, then in it was in the spring of 69, Arnie Boley, who was the dean of the School of Forestry at the time, came up to Cedar Lake, and he and Bob Wambach, who was, I think, was associate dean, and Gary Knudsen, who was working for both of them on kind of special projects over at the School of Forestry at that time, and said, we're thinking of putting a full-time resident manager at the Lubrecht Experimental Forest. Would you be interested? And I went over, and they said, we'll furnish you a house, and went over and looked at the house. My wife was not real happy with the house. It was a student, one of these, the old married student housing buildings that they have, that used to be over where the Forestry Sciences Complex is. It was built up at the Hungry Horse Reservoir after World War II, I think, is when those things were built. And then when that project was done, they kind of got scattered around. The university had a bunch of them here, and you know, you'd see them, you could recognize them. They were original prefab. They were put up in 4x8 panels and a 700 some square foot house, and it was perched up there. And the person who was running Lubrecht at that time was doing some graduate work down here, and that was kind of an additional duty and back and forth. And they used to, the foreign students at the university would work up at Lubrecht because they could do that without getting into work visa problems or whatever else, right? And so they'd go buy some really, they got some really cheap paint, right, and got painted the place, and it was just atrocious. It was ugly. But despite my wife's misgivings, it really sounded like a good opportunity for me, because we both like Western Montana anyway, and I always admired Arnie. He said, well, too, then if you want to, you know, you can kind of peck away on a master's degree, as you know, when you're here as everything else. So I took that job in 69. Mm-hmm. And there then through this last June, right? Mm-hmm. So, and I guess I always looked at it, if you got a job you like, there's no sense going looking for trouble, right? Mm-hmm. And so I kind of, I was far enough from the flagpole up there, I guess, being 30 miles out, 35 miles out. And given the nature of the deans over the years, and I don't know, I've worked for, and I've never sat out and counted, but it's got 7 or 8, 9, you know, counting interim deans and everything else. They pretty much let me run the program and grow the program and do things as we, you know, as I saw fit up there. Mm-hmm. So it was a real satisfying job, you know, from that standpoint. And I always figured that most jobs, there's three things about it. One, you like the job. Two, you like the area that the job's in. And then if you're lucky, it's enough to put some beans on the table. You know, mm-hmm. There may have been times when sometimes the beans got a little scarce in those early years. When I was moving out of Lubrecht, I looked at my first contract with the university. And I don't know, it was for $6,000 a year or something like mm-hmm. that, right? And I got thinking about it, well, you know, compared to what I was making at the end. And I always used Levi's as my shrink to fits as kind of my inflation index, right? And those things were $2 or $3 back then. I think maybe $4.50 was the most I ever paid then. And now you can't buy a set of Levi's for 30-something, right? So I figured, well, hell, I don't know if I'm making seven times. You know, I'm making maybe about, when I finally quit, I was making about seven times what I made when I started. So when it was all said and done, I don't really, you know, I don't know if I gained anything.
You're keeping up with
the
Levi's.
I kept up with the Levi inflation rate is what I did, right? But it was a great place to work, and uh-huh. having the independence, I guess, and the ability to, Arnie was really, really great about wanting the forest to become part of the community up there. The forest was given to the School of Forestry in 1937 by the Anaconda Copper Mining Company. Mm-hmm. And Lubrecht was the logging manager of Anaconda at the time, and that's where the name came from. Mm-hmm. And Charles Lubrecht, who's associated with KUFM, I think is the grandson of Lou Lubrecht, William C. Mm-hmm. Lou Lubrecht. And it was really interesting. The story goes that it took 10 years and 10 cases of scotch Tom Spaulding was the dean, that he negotiated with 10 years and 10 cases of scotch to get Lubrecht. Mm-hmm. And I thought, knowing the way the Anaconda foresters liked their liquor, I said, well, you got a heck of a deal. Right. You know, it only cost him 10 cases of scotch. But it was all cut over timber land at that time. The Blackfoot itself had been logged in three eras. The first one was the 1885 to 1900, and that there were oxen left over from the building the Transcontinental Railroads. And I've always said, I guess the oxen were too tough to eat, right? So they put in the work. And some of the city fathers that were here in Missoula, their names on the concrete downtown, had formed this big Blackfoot Milling Company, and they needed logs, and it was prior to any of the Forest Service or anything like that. And the government was just saying, yeah, we'll give you permits for $1, you know, a section or $1 an acre, you know, you just go cut. And the story goes, again, I've never tried to dig into it historically to see if it is actually true or not, but it's apocryphal, makes a good story.
Right.
That they had permits for 15 sections of land, 640 acres each, up the Blackfoot. And by the time the land office agent caught up with them, you know, they were up at 90 acres and 90 sections 15 years later, and hell, they were all the way up in Seedy Lake or up in the Clearwater. But then they cut the logs in the winter, skid them down to the river with the oxen, stack them up on the ice, and then come spring breakup, the whole kit and caboodle had come down the river, and they had a little sawmill that was down right kind of under the overpass now, down there where the town pumping area is, right at the confluence of the Blackfoot and the Clearwater. And they had a log pond there, and they'd fish the logs out. Mm-hmm.
And that was the old Simpson Dam was there.
The Simpson Dam, that came in later.
Okay.
Yeah, that was later. And the mill wasn't there. That mill came a little later, too. Mm-hmm. This was a smaller sawmill down actually at the confluence. And then the Anaconda Company then, I don't know when it was, in the teens or 20s, bought that mill, moved it up to the present site. They built that dam then so they could form a log pond, because they did the same thing then in the teens in the Potomac Valley. they took one of the old narrow gauge railroads engines and cars and brought it over, tore it apart, brought it up over the top of the Garnet Mountains from the Drummond country, Clinton country, put it together in the Blackfoot, and had a little short line railroad then that ran from what was called McNamara's Landing. And I coming down today, I noticed that place now that's got the cabins and shuttle service and such there at what has been called now more familiarly known as Johnsrud Park.
Right.
And McNamara, this they've adopted the name McNamara Landing for their business there, but it was called McNamara Landing, and they did the same thing then. Only then they skidded the by that time the oxen had died or been eaten, whatever. Right, they were using horses, and they skidded the logs then into the railroad. The railroad then hauled them down there, unloaded them, and it was the same kind of deal. And then the third period of logging was in the 20s and 30s. By that time, the railroad had moved up and went through the years, and the horses gradually faded away, and they got into the crawler tractors. And the rest of Lubbrick then was basically logged during that 20s and 30s. So what we inherited then, or what we had there then, and it was the Depression and land prices were, I had a neighbor there, Bill Potter, whose family was instrumental in starting the Ebar L. Guest Ranch there, which is maybe the oldest family-owned guest ranch in Montana. It dates back to the early 20s. He said, hell, my dad could have bought that whole mountain for, you know, $1 an acre. And he said, there were two things. Dad said, he'll never log that thing. It's too steep, you know, got it done. He said, plus, nobody had a dollar an acre, couldn't afford it anyway. So that was kind of the climate, I guess, that the dean was negotiating then with Anaconda, and he felt that we needed a, you know, should have a school forest. And I went back and looked at the Missoulian Sentinel newspaper articles of that day, and Irene Evers, who was the forestry librarian, helped me with that, and Irene just died not too many years ago, and I guess, gosh, she was in her 80s, and she was still working here at the library after the school used to have its own library. The school of forestry had its own library down in the forestry school. And I always thought Irene was responsible for more people graduated from that school of forestry because of Irene Evers, and never did any prof or anybody else. she knew where everything was. She helped guys write papers. She was fantastic woman. Anyway, I went back to these papers, and they made a big deal that the donation from Anaconda to the School of Forestry was worth just over $20,000, and they gave us 19,000 and some acres. So even with my limited math, that, you know, a buck an acre is what they valued that thing at.
Now, at some point, didn't the Northern Pacific donate land as well?
The Northern Pacific in 1939 donated two sections, roughly 640 each, that are kind of weren't a body of Lubbrick. They're right adjacent to the forest, but they're a little removed. They did in 1939. Mm-hmm. And so we've always referred to Lubbrick as having about 21,000 acres of deeded land. Mm-hmm. The boundary around Lubbrick itself, when you look at a map, encompasses about 28,000 acres or so, but there are parts of seven sections of Department of Natural Resources and Conservation land included within the boundary. Mm-hmm. And the big difference in the management of the two is that any product that comes from those land goes to support school sections or various school trusts. They were really, it was really interesting, I think, the way that came about, the Lubbrick. In March of 1937, the legislature passed an act that created the Montana Forest and Conservation Experiment Station, which is kind of the research arm, if you will, of the school or the College of Forestry. And you look at the enabling legislation for the experiment station. It goes through a whole bunch of things that they would do. You know, they'd establish and maintain this library. At one time, the School of Forestry had the state nursery, was under the School of Forestry, and they were supposed to disseminate, not, you know, all the nice sounding things, all to do. And then way down at the bottom, the last very thing is kind of a throwaway line, was to accept gifts of land for field stations. And then in October, magically, the Anaconda Company gave that land to the School of Forestry.
So somebody saw it coming.
They cooked that baby up just bigger in life, and I'm really glad they did, because it put the director of the experiment station, was also then the dean of the School of Forestry.
Mm-hmm.
Set up very similarly to the College of Agriculture. It was the same kind of thing, only this was in forestry and that was in ag. And then I guess, as I understand, there are only three legislatively established experiment stations like that. The College of Mines has an equivalent kind of mm-hmm. thing. So those three. The important thing about all that is that it gave the dean of the School of Forestry the direct role of management and deciding where the funds go. And the enabling deed from Anaconda in the legislation says that will go in support of the forest and of the experiment station activities.
Mm-hmm.
So I've always been thankful of that, because otherwise I figured, you know, George Denison or somebody would, you know, take some of that timber money and put a dome on a stadium down here or something like that, right? So it's kind of nice knowing that it would be very, very, very difficult, if not impossible, for a university-wide administrator to basically decide, well, we've got to, you know, cut a lot more trees on Lubeck because I want to do this project, or I want to do that project, or I want to do something.
Right.
So I think that was really significant.
Well, speaking of the role of deans and as well as cutting trees on Lubeck, you know, when this land was originally donated, and it was donated by the Anaconda Company and Northern Pacific, both of whom were very interested in cutting trees.
Right.
The Anaconda Company used a massive amount of timber for mining shafts and whatnot.
Right, right.
Railroad exactly. Obviously right. Consumes right. A lot of timber. So these donors are clearly interested in a College of Forestry and an experimental station in terms of wood products.
Right, right.
Now, you mentioned coming in under Dean Boley,
mm-hmm.
who I know from the Boley Commission.
Oh, okay.
Which fairly radically changed logging in this part of the country, in that it finally faced up to the issue of clear cutting.
Right.
And you came in during that time of transition.
I did, right. It, just after the Boley Report.
So if you could talk a little bit about that and how the school, if this is a correct assessment, at some point went from essentially training foresters to manage logging or to be loggers or to be in the woods for those purposes to the more conservation oriented side as we know it today.
Okay. Yeah, that's a good question. When I was in school in the early 60s, it was a timber-oriented school. And the School of Forestry, I think, from square one, has always been a public land-managing school, if you will. It was the School of Forestry, unlike many of the other colleges or school of forestry in the country, is at the liberal arts institution of the state, versus the ag, engineering, the old A&E or tech schools. If we would have followed in Montana, the example that most states would have, the School of Forestry would be over in Bozeman mm-hmm. versus here at Missoula. And the reason we got put here was the state forester's office was in Missoula, and then the Region 1 of the Forest Service was here in Missoula. So the and that was established, the School of Forestry was established, I don't know if it was right concurrent, that's something that'd be interesting to look up, either real close to the establishment of the Forest Service and the establishment right. of Region 1.
1907, 1905, 1907,
in that country.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Because what, the Forester's Ball's been in effect for, you know, just about day one of the School of Forestry.
Right.
They're up in there.
They're coming up on 100 years, 100 probably.
100 years, yeah,
too
pretty
long.
Close, yeah. But, so anyway, the School of Forestry here, from everything I've ever been able to gather, was designed and built to provide foresters to the primarily the Forest Service.
Mm-hmm.
And gosh, like in my graduating class, I would think it's safe to say that up after, particularly after World War II, as the demand for lumber and that really, really increased after the lull of the Depression and the world and all the vets came back, there must have been 95% of my cohorts, fellow graduates, went to work for the Forest Service. And it was tree harvesting oriented. You know, we also considered, because the Forest Service looked at water, recreation, range, and wildlife and timber. You know, it was a multiple use, those five, but timber was clearly the driving factor, and the others kind of came in behind it. And of course, we inherited the whole forestry concept from Europe and from primarily Germany, is where all our forestry ancestors came from.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a very regulated, and they were that culture. You were a forester, and a Forstmeister was a fairly prestigious position in the community, because they had been growing forests for centuries, and with their limited land base, it was really, really critical that they treat trees as a growing crop.
Mm-hmm.
And so we just assumed, you know, and foresters built that into their culture, I guess, and psyche and everything else. And we assumed then that, and we inherited this concept of even age management, if you will, that same way. You kind of treat trees like fields of corn on steroids, right? You
right.
grow them up and whack them down, thin them out a little bit, and whack, grow them and whack them and grow them and whack them. And the old standard textbook methods, you clear cut it, or you cut most of the trees and left some seed trees, and that's the way we were, you know, we were taught. And the Forest Service, of course, was carrying on this cutting tradition, because we had lots of trees, and we needed the wood in the country, and the mills, and the whole nine yards. So they were in the timber production business. There's no other way around it. The timber drove the forest.
Mm-hmm.
And quite frankly, the foresters, you know, we were our own worst enemies from that standpoint, is that we kind of got into this whole tunnel vision that, well, it was, if we picked up the old German culture of growing trees, that was an altogether different culture, an altogether different set of circumstances, and we try to transpose that then on primarily the Western landscape and the Intermountain landscape versus the Southeast or the West Coast, where they had the growing conditions and moisture and da-da-da-da. They could grow trees in a relatively rapid time. And clear-cutting that whole controversy, clear-cutting a very, very legitimate tool, still is, And historically, wildfires were the initial clear cutters, if you will, in some forest types. You get into the lodgepole and primarily in western larch. And in the higher elevations, they get these stand replacement fires every 100, 150, 200 years to wipe things out and it start on over again. Well, where we really made our big mistake as foresters generically is we took, okay, that works fine in Douglas fir or lodgepole and larch on north-facing slopes at 6,000 feet, and then they imposed it down here on the bitterroot on south-facing slopes in a ponderosa pine type, where ponderosa pine historically was a fire regime species where it grew in a multi or uneven aged stands with lots of frequent fires going through it versus one great big one every couple hundred years. And put it out there in those dry hillsides, and Christ, it planted trees till, you know, hell froze over, and they couldn't get them to survive because it was hot, baking. Mm-hmm. So then they got into the terracing where they built little mini roads across the contours to give them a flat spot and a little bit of relief from that sun. That's where people then looked up and said, you know, are we going to turn the forests, the national forests of Western Montana, into industrial tree farms? And I think that's where Arnie and Dick Shannon Behan, you know, and some of the others said, you know, this isn't going to, you know, we've got to look at other things. I mean, or there are other ways, and you know, it wasn't. I don't think that they weren't against timber at all. It was just, you know, we finally carried it, in their opinion, too far, mm-hmm. and we couldn't justify the types of expense we were putting into the ground to try to grow trees. Mm-hmm. And Arnie caught a lot of grief over that, an awful lot of grief. In fact, there was a, you know, period of estrangement, I think, from the School of Forestry with not only the Forest Service, but then also the State Forester's Office and some of these others. And, you know, because they here was a the dean of the School of Forestry, you know, was a heretic and saying, my God, we shouldn't be, you know, shouldn't be doing clear cuts in the bitter. And I think, I don't know if I would say that was a transformation point for the School of Forestry. I really don't think it was, in mm-hmm. my opinion. I don't think schools, colleges and universities, I don't think, by and large, lead the charge when it comes to changing values or things in society. I say that after spending my whole life with the university, right? But what I've observed is society outside of the university, and whether it be business or society in general, is changing. And then university gets a hold of it, right? And I think the same thing happened in our School of Forestry. Mm-hmm. And we made that change from basically being a saw log oriented school. You know, it was kind of a high class vo-tech school with a 4-year degree, but we were trained to grow and cut trees, you know, and I guess I've never felt any need to apologize for that education, because we really got a good, strong, technical education. We didn't get, in my opinion, enough of the social and the society and the people things that we should have, but when you look at the people that graduated in whatever, and I think it's still true today, people in the natural resource field have to have a really strong biological professional background and training. And then in addition to that, increasingly more and more, they need the people skills to go with it. Mm-hmm. But you have to have both of them. You cannot have just the technical skills, by and large. And you sure can't just have people skills and not know what the hell you're talking about when it comes to the biology and the science and that associated with whether you're dealing in wildlife or trees or water or whatever else. You got to have that mm-hmm. combination. And so I think that over the years, those people that inherently had the people skills, like dealing with people and these kinds of things, and you know, moved on into the more, maybe into more of the management positions and these kinds of things. And the other folks that were enjoyed and were comfortable doing the more technical things, you know, that were more the woods oriented mm-hmm. kind of foresters. So I think, but what really changed, I don't think the School of Forestry didn't change the profession. The Forest Service changed. And society said to the Forest Service, hey, there's more value out there than just growing and cutting trees. And now it's gotten to, you know, very, very extreme, where there are a couple of these groups in town particularly, you know, that they don't want to see a tree cut on the National Forest. I mean, that's Jake Brelick and Matt, what's his name? You know, I mean, that's their position in life. They are ignoring reality, and they're ignoring biology, and that trees grow and die and need, are going to be replaced. And you know, it's one thing when the white man, you know, was like pre-honky, it didn't really make a hell of a lot of difference, right? I mean, we could have the fires, and the Indians and Native people were comfortable with, they would move when the fires came, and you know, back and forth, they started them, whatever. And they weren't making any untold demands on those forests. Mm-hmm. And so the natural rhythms and systems worked really well. Well, they don't now. Mm-hmm. Just, you know, it's, they talk about forest health and human health. Well, hell, it's human health's going to win out every time. And we can't burn slash, you know, without, if we get smoke in the valley, oh my God, right? And 63, you could hardly see across the valley with all the teepee burners and everything right. else. But, you know, again, all that has changed, and so the school has changed also. You know, in not leading the charge, but recognizing, mm-hmm. okay, you know, they don't have, we're turning out a lot of ologists now of different kinds right. because that's what the Forest Service is hiring. You know, they're not hiring engineers, they're not hiring foresters, because hell, they're not cutting any trees.
So with those perspectives, that you know, a lot of modern forestry is not necessarily the way it's always been done, or natural, somebody might say, but that also there is the demand. You mentioned that in your time as director at Lubricht, you had the leeway under numerous deans to change and grow the program as you saw fit. Mm-hmm. What sort of trends in forestry were you following? What directions did you move in? Some specific examples of things that go on out at the experimental forest that maybe okay. have changed?
Okay.
I mean, if you go out there now, there are lots of varying age stands of trees.
That's right.
And you
that's
mentioned
right.
that, of course, when you first got this land, it was all cut over.
Well, it was cut over, but it was not cut over in the sense that it was a clear cut or anything like that. Mm-hmm. When you were given, they were dealing early on with horses, logging, oxen, cross-cut saws and axes. They weren't logging on the slopes. They weren't taking trees that were real large, that would have some defect in them or have double tops, this kind of stuff, because time they had to handsaw that sucker down and then cut out the rod or cut off the other, they wouldn't fool with those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And they just took trees that were about 12 inches through diameter, at 4.5 feet or so, because they wanted a top diameter of their logs that would be about 12 inches in diameter. For the technology and the saws that they had in those days. Mm-hmm. So any tree smaller than that, they just left stand. And particularly in the young ponderosa pine, bull pine it's called, it's a heavy, it's a very, very, the wood's very heavy when it's young, full of a lot of water. And those suckers would sink in the ponds, right? And so they didn't want to cut those things and float them down the river because hell, they'd sink. Right? So what we inherited at Lubrecht was a real hodgepodge. We had some areas, in fact, both those, the railroad sections had never been logged. They were too high and inaccessible in the 30s. They had never been logged. And other areas of the forest had been logged in varying degrees of intensity, I guess. So we had a kind of a hodgepodge. We had trees that had not been cut, big old growth. We had trees that were too small to cut when they there. And then we had other areas that at the time they cut had a lot of commercial trees, so those were pretty much wiped out and all we had was reproduction. And so we spent a lot of the cutting that we did on Lubrecht in the time I was there was in a commercial thinning, cleanup, salvage kind of a mode. And these last 10-15 years in the ponderosa pine, with the help of Carl Feeder, who's a research silviculturist there at the school, and really, really one of the top experts, I guess, I hate to use that word, when it comes to uneven age management, where you have a range of tree sizes and ages on a given piece of ground, so you don't go through the cut, regenerate, thin, cut, grow. You always have trees of varying sizes. In the ponderosa pine type, it works beautifully. And the bulk of the forest is in that ponderosa pine Douglas fir type. So that was the kind of stuff that we did there in Lubrecht. We did lots of thinning trials at varying densities and spacings and different machinery and stuff that you could use to remove that material. We did an awful lot of biomass stuff in the mid 80s, and it's kind of interesting they're kind of rediscovering that now, but we did an awful lot with small farm tractors and small equipment, basically full tree skidding, bringing the whole tree, guts, feathers and everything out to the landing, processing what we could get from the bowl for small saw logs or things like that, and then the rest of it chipped and used for hog fuel. And things were working really good then until Montana Power said, so they dropped their natural gas rate, and that pretty well took care of using biomass in those days. So yeah, it was really interesting. They gave the pulp mill a little better interruptible rate of power, they called it, right? So it didn't make it economic, and now we're going around again. So I think in the management is the biggest, our biggest responsibility. I look at more as stewardship. I am a firm believer in the term of being a land steward. And part of that stewardship is maintaining options. I think the best thing is we're here for such a very short time, or any land manager or land steward is here for such a very short time in the life of the forest or in the life of the landscape, that our biggest responsibility is to pass that land along with the maximum amount of options for the next generation or the next manager, whatever. Mm-hmm. And in some of these these harsher cutting systems, you've pretty well locked in. If you go out and you do in fact clear cut, you've pretty well locked yourself into that system for at least 30 or 40 years and 50 until the trees get up where you could maybe do something else. And again, I think in the mix of management, and again, if we're going to try to duplicate in our modern management now, if you will, not look at it just as tree farms, but trying to mimic nature a little bit, duplicate nature, work with nature versus saying, well, by God, we're going to enforce our system upon it. We have to look at systems that mimic that, and clear cuts and some of these others do. Now, you don't have to go up like we tended to do, nice big square blocks on the side of the mountain, right? They said, my God, right? And we made them too big in lots of instances where they wouldn't naturally recede in these. But you know, technically, they can handle all that kind of stuff now. So, and so then we worked a lot with the landowners in the Blackfoot, and we did a lot of cooperative programs in forestry. We did a lot in recreation. We had that the Blackfoot River Corridor project up there in the early 70s, and helped work with the Nature Conservancy and others to get conservation easement legislation passed in the state, and we're still working with the Nature Conservancy. And in 1970, they had one man that was responsible for everything west of the Mississippi, and he was located in San Francisco. And the Nature Conservancy today in Montana alone has a staff of 25 people, right? So things have really, really changed when it comes to, you know, the whole land saving, land conservation, and the change in the ownerships and the patterns and all these kinds of things. And then in, so we, when I started there in Lubrec, we did a little timber stuff because we were always self-sufficient by and large. And then over the years, we expanded in our timber. In 1957, Dean Williams, I think was the dean at that time. Yeah, I think so. He had called Fred Gerlach, prof, into the office, and Fred said, "Fred, we're going to have a spring camp program. And the kids, the people need to get out in the woods." And he said, he told Fred, you're gonna lead it up, and we're going to hold it this first year out at the Bear Creek Logging Camp, Anaconda's Bear Creek Logging Camp up the Blackfoot. In those days, deans had a lot more authority, right? If they pulled something like that, now the teachers' union would have a cat, right? And they'd be screaming, ah, you can't, you know, can't make it, you know. And Fred saluted and said, "Yes, sir." Well, we were on the quarter system then. I think all the school, maybe not Billings, but the two major universities anyway, were on the quarter system. And so they said, okay, the sophomores in the School of Forestry will attend a sophomore spring camp, spend their 10 weeks in the woods. And they did that in 1957, I think it was. And then 1958, during that summer period, they moved the old logging boxcar, railroad boxcar logging, from the camp to Lubrec, set them up there at Lubrec. And then they had one of the summer crews, we had a little sawmill there, and they went ahead and built some smaller cabins, built a little cook shack and a men's bathroom, because there weren't any women in forestry in those days, it wasn't it. And so they held then the spring camp up there, where they spent the 10 weeks of the spring quarter doing, we had ecology class, we had a surveying, we had forest measurements, we had some fire. It was a 17 credits. It was a strong, tough curriculum. And then I took it in 60. When I was the first year I came, I did my tour up there. And then in addition to that, for a few years, we had a senior camp the same way. And that was up at Libby at the old J. Neal's number, Happy's Inn, up on Highway 2. And that was really, I guess that may have been the high point of the real, you know, forestry, growing and cutting of trees emphasis in the School of Forestry, you know, went through, it started in 57, it was terminated in 60, well, it was terminated in 69. And again, that was a reflection, I think, of, you know, the changing values and everything that was going on. And then it was started up again in 75, I think, 74 or 5. And it went on through just on a voluntary basis until it was 92 or 93 when the university, in all their wisdom, and I really think that decision really sucked, in my opinion, that the move from the quarter system to the semester system. I guess I say that from a, and I hope I'm not saying it just because, well, as it was the old days, that's the way it should have been. But it was touted as saving money and doing this, and Billings, I think, was on the time, and I think the two university presidents were kind of in a spitting contest with the Board of Regents, and the Board of Regents said, well, my God, we'll show you who's boss, right? And so they put everybody on the semester system, and it does have some advantages, I'm sure, in that the students can get into a subject a little longer. It has the real disadvantage of you can't take as many different classes. You can't broaden yourself any because you're locked in for the whole semester. Whereas with a quarter, you could, and what we did in the school, and I'm sure other departments did, on some of these, in some of the subject areas, they'd be just a continuation of the next quarter. You know, it'd be 201 and 202 or something, right? Mm-hmm. You'd put one in the fall mm-hmm. quarter and one in this winter or whatever. And it really lent itself well to the field-oriented classes because then kids would come out in April, and 1st of April, then March, you're still maybe snowing stuff on the ground, but you knew it was eventually going away. So you could spend April and May and out there. And mm-hmm. I was involved in the last, 15 years we had that I taught the forest measurements class out of Blue Brick. So I got, really got to know a lot of the students over the years that mm-hmm. way. And the kids always said, in all those years of the students coming and going, I never heard, everybody has come back, literally everyone, and said, that was the best quarter that I spent, or that was the best, time I spent mm-hmm. in school. I worked harder out at camp than I ever did anywhere else, but they tended to work in crews, and, it was, nowadays, they grow a lot of trees virtually on the computer, right? But, getting out there, learning to work with people and, learning what the real trees look like, there's quite a little of that, mm-hmm. I think, missing.
So you mentioned getting people out to the woods, and that was a push to get, and primarily you've talked about getting students out, but I know from my own experience, I've been out to Lubbock to hunt. I've skied the trails out okay. there, mm-hmm. even when they used to have chili feeds and stuff.
Oh, yeah, the right. yeah, they still do, yeah.
I've been out there and stayed in those cabins with the university's cross-country team for camps.
Oh, okay.
And so clearly at some point, it started being available to the public in more ways and having not necessarily what you'd consider forestry and conservation activities going on out there. Right. One thing that I've heard a lot talked about is the Round River program that went right. out there, which wasn't necessarily forestry.
No, it was 180 degrees from forestry, really.
Yeah. Share some of those sort of activities that have gone on.
Do you remember when the Round River was, for example? It was in the 70s sometime. My memory for dates is terrible.
I've heard it mentioned a lot, and I don't know much about it.
Well, some of their, Tom Powers mm-hmm. was involved, and Dunsmore.
Tom Powers, of course, is an economy professor here.
And Roger Dunsmore, who I think just retired not too many years ago in the philosophy department. Mm-hmm. It was a real green... it was the mother of all environmental programs. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think those were the days when, Tom and these other guys had the bear or had the Bass Creek commune. They were living down in the Bitterroot. And they brought that concept there to Lubbock, and they had sweat lodges, and the whole nine yards, and made some of the locals a little nervous about, what the hell are all those hippies doing up at Lubbock? Mm-hmm. It was great. I thought. Mm-hmm. It was good. But that was maybe the most radical change that the use of Lubric, you know, in the old traditional, pretty straight-laced, you know, old-time forester, wood-oriented, right? And here come all these, you know, these tree huggers, you know, with this and that and whatever going on. But again, it was a reflection of the times. Mm-hmm. And I made a point, I guess. We had the camp facility then, and it was really only used by the school in the spring. And it was kind of word of mouth then, well, you know, Lubric's up there in the summer. They don't, you know, can we do, you know, like the cross-country teams, other universities. Iowa State University's got a forestry school. Again, they were with the, in Ames, Iowa, well, Christ, it's 500 miles from a tree in Ames, Iowa almost, right? And the same thing with Oklahoma State University in Stillwater, Oklahoma. Same thing. I mean, there were some trees over on the Arkansas border, but, you know, it's not in the heart of it. So they had traveling camps, and they said, oh, here's, you know, we can go to Lubric. So we started, you know, they would come around every 3-4 years. You always knew when the profs were fishermen, fly fishermen, because they'd come out to Montana. If they were musky fishermen, they'd go to Minnesota, Cocaine mm-hmm. Forest or something. Right. So we started using it there, and we made it, again, it was part of Arnie's, and I really took to heart with Arnie to try to make Lubric not some, you know, pointy-headed research station of the universities just stuck out here in the valley, that we were, in fact, a part of the valley. And so we used it for valley-wide activities, and we had the first cross-country ski trails, you know, I think the whole Missoula area. It was in the, again, maybe the mid-70s, one of the recreation classes wanted to establish a cross-country, and we inherited the old road systems there, and we had lots of loop things, and they put out the first map and stuff in the mid-70s, and the thing's still, you know, still going strong. There have been others around.
When there's snow, anyway.
When there's snow, yeah. This last year was a good one. And we've went up and down, first allowing dogs and not dogs and back and forth, and we got into trouble with some of the more purist types. But we all said, okay, then we've kept it as kind of a family. You know, if you want to come out with your dog, great. If you don't like dogs on the trail, then, you know, you can go to Lolo Pass, or you can go to some place that charges you a little bit, and they keep the dogs off and do mm-hmm. it. And that's really worked out well. Mm-hmm. The forest always been open for all kinds of recreation activities. We joined in the walk-in hunting areas, in fact, helped start those in the mid-70s. Same thing then with that recreation program along the river where we took 30 miles of the Blackfoot from Johns Root Park up to the Missoula County line, which is now Rustgates Park. And 85% of that 33 miles was in private ownership, and we established day access use and some overnight camping, primarily on not the overnight camping, but the day access use on private land. And this was well before the stream access law came in, and looked at cooperative programs. How can we throw what resources we have together on the table and develop these kinds of things? And that evolved then into get the Trout Unlimited chapter in the Blackfoot that has dealt with mine issues, and now the Blackfoot Challenge that has been going for 13 years with mm-hmm. you know, a watershed ridgetop to ridgetop kind of approach. So we've been working together up there for, you know, lots of years, and then the use at Lubric just kind of naturally developed, because we had a hell of a lot going on, and we had always a real small staff. It was myself, and then in the 80s, I finally got a forester, Frank Moss, who was the forester there. And then Dean Stout, Ben Stout, we were able to get through the Murdoch Foundation. We got the Forestry Center built in 82, and then we were really able to serve not only the community, but the university is kind of a continuing education facility. and held professional short courses, but then old German immersion workshops and all those other folks used to come on up, and we welcomed that because we looked at it as a resource, not just for the School of Forestry, but for the university and the larger community. And then again, because we were largely self-sufficient, you know, it made sense for us to rent things out and, you know, at least meet some expenses and do some things that way. And then in 95, the lodge was built, and over my pretty strong objections, I got overruled on that one. I knew we couldn't pay for it, and it was part of, and I disagreed very strongly with the president, not directly to the president, but through my dean. That
who was pushing for the building of that?
Well, it was part of President Dennison's when he, you know, we did the, well, they built the new dorm, but then they did the continuing education center down here, the print shop, they redid the university theater, you know, and in all those instances, you know, the people that were managing it, right, there's no way in hell we're going to pay for these things, right? And it's proved out we could, right? And, well, you know, the problems with the universities, you know, with the field house and da-da-da-da, we've been paying for that, and, you know, it used to be, there used to be, what, money available, I thought, here at the university, for extra things, right? The emphasis wasn't always on, you got to make money for this, you got to do this, this, and this. And, you know, part of the changing culture, I guess, not only at this university, but nationally, is, you know, that we got to make money and develop, you know. And some of that is to, you know, I felt was to pay for some of those kinds of things. So what we're doing up there is we're subsidizing the lodge facility by, through the sale of timber. You know, I personally, and we've gotten into then over the years, these last 10 years or so since we had the lodge, we've been, you know, gosh, we've got weddings and, you know, all this kind of stuff, which really is not our mission in life. We're doing it because we're trying to make a bond payment that there's no way we can make the bond payment, right? So, it's been a distraction, I really feel, in the last, you know, last 10 years. We, before we had the facility available and people used it, they knew it was rustic, you know, a euphemism for early American junk, right? But they expected that, and we charged them accordingly, and, you know, everybody was happy. And now the lodge is kind of a, you know, so. Bastardization, a little bit of a Motel 6 in a dormitory, right? And yeah, it's kind of the same, I guess, I look at the same way with the Sponge Island, you know, the center at Salmon Lake. You know, again, is that a legitimate, you know.
Maybe you got to keep pace with the Paul's Up next door.
Well, yeah, that's an altogether different story, yeah.
Well, I sort of want to end by making something that struck me as an analogy for you personally, that you started out with, that leads me to a question, which is, you know, you started talking about you were growing up in Wisconsin and you had a Lutheran minister as a father. You became attracted to the West and the mountains, and you know that's in the that I feel like I've heard that story before, and I'm thinking of John Muir and Aldo Leopold, and they're both spent their young life on farms in Wisconsin, had ministers as fathers. Fell in love with the West and forestry and the national forest.
Arlie Boley, same way.
Arlie Boley. And so there's this tradition that you fall right with personally, as well as your interest in what your career has been. And so my question is, also, the university's forestry program has, since its inception, been one of the top in the country, if not one of the only ones. And I think when this school opened, you know, there was one at Yale, maybe.
Yeah.
And those two have clearly been the stands out.
Coincidentally, up until the School of Forestry changed their name to the College of Forestry and Conservation, there were only two schools of forestry in the United States, mm-hmm. here at Montana and at Yale.
And at Yale.
And I always said Yale was in pretty good company.
Right. And so on that note, being that Yale's in the company of the University of Montana and that you're in the company of people like John Muir and Leo Leopold and Aldo Leopold and Boley, what's your, if you can make it singular, what's your legacy from the, I guess, 35 years?
37 or whatever.
You clearly aren't claiming the lodge as your legacy.
No,
so
no.
What have you left there that will be memorable, will be historic?
What I would hope to leave there would be a spirit of working together to solve stuff in the valley. I guess I look at my time at Lubrecht not as looking back and saying, well, I built the camp from here to here, we built the staff, we did all that kind of... I would look at it more where Lubrecht fits in the context of the valley and how the Blackfoot Valley has been a real leader and continues to be a real leader nationally when it comes to solving resource-oriented problems by sitting down at the table and saying, okay, we'll park our ego at the door, we'll park our company culture at the door. We don't really care who gets credit for it, but let's try to solve this problem. And again, on the option standpoint, pass on what we've tried to take care of, whether it's 5 years or 35 years, and pass that on to the next set of people in a better condition than we found it. And to me, that's the most important thing you can do. Mm-hmm. And that's been the most satisfying is that I've had some just beautiful people to work with. Lan Lindbergh, my neighbor and friend for all these years. Bill Potter the same way. I've been very, very fortunate in having a string of deans that will let me go ahead, have let me over the years go ahead and move Lubrecht in that, you know, in that, and make it an open place where we're there. We don't care what kind of activity or what kind of research activity. I mean, we've had some really crazy things go on up there, but that's what we're there for. We're there for to serve, I guess, and maybe that's part of the Lutheran ministry background. Mm-hmm. Is the idea of service. You know, that's what we're there for, and that's a thing that has bothered me about the university. That if I had to say there was a negative change that I've seen, I haven't really thought about this all that much, but it strikes me now and then, is that when I first became associated with the university, I've always been on the staff level, never at, you know, a professor. I've been a visiting fireman professor, but never anything official. It was research, teaching, and public service. Those were the three main goals and mission of the university. I can remember that, you know, bang, bang, bang. And it seems to me like the public service mission has gradually faded from the university's goals and objectives. Mm-hmm. And I may be harsh and I may be, you know, I'm looking at it from maybe a position of being more at Lubrecht than being a, you know, a everyday member of the university community. But it really seems to me that way. Mm-hmm. And looking at recognition and compensation in the teaching and in the professional, in the professors, they used to recognize, you know, they didn't try to take everybody and fit them into that round hole of teaching or the square hole of research. If they contributed in a larger community sense, that counted. That was, you know, Pax Vobiscum, my son, go forward, right? Mm-hmm. But now I wonder about that. It's generating funds has maybe replaced public service, I don't know.
So I said that was going to be my last question. As you mentioned that crazy things have gone on out there. Give me one of them. Craziest memory.
We had a student just here 4 or 5 years ago, a pathology student that wanted wanted to study the decomposition rates of flesh, right? And he had a pig. And the university was a little narrow-minded about him putting this dead pig in a cage in the middle of the oval, right, and letting the thing decompose so he could come out and do it. So he came out to Lubeck and said, I need a place, you know, for this to go on. And we said, that's fine. You know, just make sure it's downwind to camp, right? And he did. You know, that one has always kind of struck me as being funny. And then we also have had, you know, for gosh, since Ben Stout's era, and we've been, 15 years or more, we've had the wood-fired pottery kiln up at Lubeck, too. And they, I can never pronounce that. Amagonin something, you know. And one year when the gas, when their gas kilns here didn't work, you know, they did all their stuff up there. And Dave Smith, the guy that started as a grad student, great guy. Now some, you know, pretty big muckety-muck professor at the University of Wisconsin and, you know, all this, and he'd come back in the summers. And they rebuilt it once, so, you know. I've always said, you know, you talk about true multiple use and whatever. Well, we've, you know, and it's located right out there in, you know, in the woods. And so all those Philistine foresters, we have a pottery kiln right in the middle of us, right? So right. That's been great.
Great. Well, it's a fascinating place, and I appreciate you sharing your time and memories about it with me.
I can go on forever when it comes to that. You know, I guess a lot of downloading to do after all those years. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Getz.
You bet.